This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
What did you do on your last vacation? Hit the slopes for a little skiing? Fly to an island and get some sun? Or, maybe discover a new form of eukaryotic life?
So whenever I go on a vacation, I usually take these 50 milliliter tube, so we call it Falcon tube, all the biology student probably know what it is. It doesn't have to be those. Sometimes I even use just soda bottle.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series continues with the discovery of this unique form of life and what it means for the study of the origins of life on Earth. We'll also spend an academic minute letting you know what arrangements you should make if you ever want to sleep with a lemur. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Eukaryotic life. I'll let that sink in for a second because you're going to hear those words a lot in the next few minutes. It's a form of microscopic life that holds many clues to the origins of all life on Earth. That's what Dr. Eun-Soo Kim studies and searches for, even while traveling on vacation. Dr. Kim is assistant curator in the Division of Invertebrate Zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. She sat down and spoke to The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about her studies as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
I work on single-celled organisms, so they're very simple already. So there are many different kinds of single-cell organisms. A lot of them maybe you are familiar with are bacteria, but what I study are called as protists, which means that they are eukaryotic and then fundamentally different from prokaryotic bacteria because they have these subcellular compartment called nucleus where cell's genomic information is stored. So in case of bacteria and archaebacteria, maybe I should not talk about archaebacteria, maybe it's getting complicated.
That's okay. Keep going and maybe you can All draw right. a little picture for us of what All you're right. looking at as well.
So in case of bacteria, their cell's genomic information, DNA, is not contained within nucleus, but it's just more or less floating in the cytoplasm. So that's the major distinction between prokaryotic life and eukaryotic life. So I'm working on a little bit more complex eukaryotic life.
That's exactly what I was about to say. So it sounds like what you're studying is more complex than this bacteria you were talking about.
So eukaryotic life include not only protists, but also human and other animals and plants and fungi. So I'm studying things more closely related to plant life and animal life, a little bit more distantly related to bacterial life. But as I will describe later, the parts of us, a part of the protist evolved from bacterial life form through symbiotic relationships.
And these relationships, if we go back an immense amount of time, almost an unfathomable amount of time, to that
maybe a billion or 2 billion or 3 billion. Yes.
Right. So we're going to the mid-Proterozoic era. And that's what you're basically studying, the idea that these protists came about in that era. And they were involved in this intricate dance in the origins of life and the early development of the planet.
So what I'm interested in is life existed more than 3 billion years. So eukaryotic life evolved after bacterial life evolved. So in a sense, what I'm studying is more like a later event. So I'm particularly interested in how first photosynthetic eukaryotic cell evolve through this process of symbiosis between early single-celled eukaryotic cell that engulfed free-living cyanobacteria, the photosynthetic cell. So what I'm interested in is this event that happened perhaps somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 billion years ago when early eukaryotic cell engulfed free-living cyanobacterial cell, which instead of being digested by the host, persisted inside a cytoplasm and evolved into organelle now known as chloroplast, which occur within plants. That's responsible for the green coloration in plants and also occur in many different kind of algae, including green algae, a red algae, and some other type of algae that we see in modern day freshwater and marine waters.
So to bring everybody into the conversation, it sounds like, and this is a word we're all aware of in our early science classes, that you're looking at these connections that are made leading up to photosynthesis?
So photosynthesis evolved even earlier than this. What I'm talking about is evolution of photosynthesis in eukaryotic life. Then they got this capacity to harvest light energy, not by themselves, but by taking the capacity from bacteria.
From the bacteria.
Yeah,
But how are they using light?
So basically, they are converting light energy into the chemical energy, which is sort of usable by the cell. So like in case of animals, like humans, we cannot utilize light energy directly. But there are these photosynthetic cell that has a capacity to convert light energy into the chemical energy like ATP that we use to sort of drive all the metabolic activities.
And as you saying that these more complex cells you're looking at, these protists, were able to develop this system for using the sun's light to convert it into energy.
So by just basically they are utilizing these cyanobacterial capacity to utilize light energy. So instead of like inventing the whole photosynthesis system, they just capture these photosynthetic bacterial cell inside its cytoplasm.
So they could take advantage of the sun's light.
Right. So that's what's happening.
Sure. Well, this is phenomenal. Now, if we go back to this era you're studying, we know that earlier, many different periods as it evolved, the Earth was extremely hot, boiling, in fact, burning. But in this era, I would imagine the Earth is much cooler for a lot of these processes to take place, yes?
Probably was not boiling, but at least what I know is the oxygen concentration was not as high as what we have today. So the evolution of these photosynthetic eukaryotes was important later in for the evolution of animal life because these eukaryotic photosynthesis sort of contributed significantly to the buildup of the oxygen in the air, one of the essential conditions for the rise of animal, and which happened about 500 million years ago.
We're talking to Dr. Eunsoo Kim. This doesn't occur in a vacuum. In other words, there's a lot of different forces at work here that create the opportunity for these protists to take advantage of the cyanobacteria and utilize the sun's light. And as you mentioned here, what are we talking about? We're talking about the origin of life on Earth and how it came to be. And it sounds like part of what's going on here in your study is this rise in oxygen levels on the Earth. Now, we know that those levels over the long history of the Earth have gone up and gone down and have varied over time until, you know, modern day where we have enough to breathe in and breathe out and survive. But this is a major era for raising the oxygen level on the planet Earth and then what comes from that, yes?
Yeah, so the thing is that the cyanobacteria existed longer time period. Perhaps they existed more than 3 billion years, even before eukaryotic cell evolved, so that they contributed already to the buildup of the oxygen into the air, but once the photosynthesis capacity transferred into the eukaryotic cell, and then that accelerated the buildup of the oxygen in the later period.
So it's almost exponential in that more begets more begets more begets more.
I guess it all depends on the type of the cell body. I guess the oxygen buildup is based on these equations, so not just the primary oxygen production, but also once the organism die and then it get all
decomposes,
and then that get consumed the oxygen. So the oxygen buildup only happens when the organic materials get buried in the sediments. Then when the respiration happens, when the organic materials get degraded, then that use up the oxygen.
So, I see. So there's a plus and a minus there.
Right. So for instance, if there's a one organism that made a lot of oxygen, but then the whole biomass that was created by photosynthesis got completely degraded by respiration by other organism. There's no net accumulation of oxygen. There should be some kind of organic material barrier in order to see the net increase in oxygen.
Sure.
Some of the cyanobacteria has a tough cell wall, and then they somehow get buried long geological time span, and then that sort of we start to see the oxygen build up. And same with some eukaryotic algae, those with some decay resistant scale, and like some haptophyte organism. You probably remember these massive white chalk deposit in Dover.
Yeah, sure.
And those were formed when these tiny little microbial algae haptophytes accumulated over millions of time span. So these haptophyte algae often are covered with very delicate scales, and which are decay resistant, and are the main ingredient of that kind of chalk deposit. And when that kind of thing happened, then also like sort of when that kind of organic materials get deposited in the sedimentary instead of getting degraded by aerobic respiration, then that sort of give us the net increase in oxygen in the air.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Eunsoo Kim continues with a talk about her vacation habits. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1225. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Eunsoo Kim, Assistant Curator in the Division of Invertebrate Zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
Let's go back for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a little video of you, Dr. Kim, and you said you went to Prince Edward Island with friends and found a new species of protus. You know, when I go on vacation, I don't find new species. But you went and found a new species. And I don't think, you know, on the grand scale, people understand that on this microscopic level, there is so much still to be discovered. Can you talk about that and about what your discovery was?
So whenever I go on a vacation, I usually take these 50 milliliter tube. So we call it Falcon tube, I think. All the biology student probably know what it is, what I'm talking about. So it's a tiny little plastic tube. It doesn't have to be those special scientific equipment you can take. Sometimes I even use just soda bottles or water bottles.
Don't tell the TSA.
And you just need a tiny little bit of water. I mean, even in a drop of water, depending on where you go, you can see many different kind of microorganisms living inside of that water. So I just bring back a tiny little bit of water and take a look at them under microscope and give them some nutrient and put them into a stable, like a growth condition. And a couple days later, I start to see things growing. And I use these pasture pipette. So
what's that?
The pasture pipette is like a glass sort of the pipette. And you put a little rubber bulb on the other hand, and then you just use it. You probably use it in your chemistry class just to transfer some liquid into...
Like an eyedropper, like a little...
Yeah, like an eyedropper, yes.
You just pick up a little liquid with it, and then you squeeze a little bit of liquid in the next tube.
That is right. The trick that we do is we use the glass pipette, and we just heat up the tip of the pipette and use a forceps. And then when the glass is more or less melted, we take it out of the frame, and then we just stretch it out. So just make tip really, really, really thin. So using that one, we just use it just to pick up individual cells of protus. So
and you can literally get an individual cell.
Yeah, as long as they're not so tiny, that when it gets to bacterial size, typically less than 1 micron, that's really hard with these kind of pipette. But if they are around like a 5 micron or larger, then yes, that's not that difficult. And we just pick out individual cell and then transfer them into a fresh medium and see whether they grow.
And analyze them. So you were in Prince Edward Island and you found a new species.
Yeah.
So tell us.
Yeah, so we went to Prince Edward Island, went to beach, and had just a little bit of water, and just, let's say, 10 or 20 milliliter water, and that's just plenty to see hundreds of different kind of microorganisms, and brought those tubes back to the lab and added this nutrient medium that contained a little bit of soil extract. So at the time, I was interested in growing heterotrophic organism. So heterotrophic organism means that they feed on bacteria or other particles to support their growth and survival, as opposed to autotrophic organism. As we discussed before, they can make their own food, either by using light or some other kinds of energy source. So by adding this oil extract, then that promotes the growth of many type of bacteria. And then some of the protists, they feed on those bacteria, and And then I started to see some interesting proteins growing in them and did a re-isolation using this finely drawn Pasteur pipette and established the monocultures of many different kind of proteins. And at least three of them turn out to be a new species and new genus. And then one of which has been formally described and published a couple of years ago. And I'm doing some genome sequencing project on that particular organism.
What are we calling it?
So that one is called Goniomonas avonlea. So scientific name has two parts. The first part is genus name and second part is called a specific epithet. So Goniomonas is a genus name and avonlea is a species epithet.
And what about Dr. Kim?
So these Goniomonas is already existing genus name. I came up with avonlea. So I went to my primary motivation to go to Prince Edward Island is because I'm a big fan of these novel Anne of Green Gable.
Anne of
Green Gable. And the Avonlea is the name of the fictional town in that novel. And then since I collected the water near this in a beach area where I guess the fictional town was located, so I decided to use the Avonlea.
How wonderful. Wow, what a great story. So one of the things is you discover a species, you get to name it.
That is right. So some scientists name after their own name, or there is this interesting protist name, Cafeteria. And then actually the name literally came from the fact that
they found it in the cafeteria.
In the cafeteria in their own school campus.
I was just about to ask you,
yeah,
how many of us could open our refrigerators right now and discover new protists?
Well, I'm not really sure about the refrigerator, but maybe in a New York City subway system, you see all these puddles. You may be able to find some cool microorganism living in that kind of...
They're all around us. That's
all
the point.
Yes, not just in a vacation spot. It could be just, you know, like a little puddle in your backyard. People keep finding a new novel microorganism inside your body, too. So we humans associate with many different kind of microorganisms on our skin and also internally. So a lot of them still remain to be, I guess, characterized.
Okay, a couple more questions. First, what do green algae and the spotted salamander have to do with each other?
All right, so you're talking about this project that I've been working with over a couple of years with my collaborator. So I'm a microbiologist. I know very little about salamander. So that work sort of is in collaboration with my herpetologist colleague, Dr. Ryan Kearney, who's at the Gettysburg College, assistant professor at Gettysburg College. And also I'm recently working also with Dr. Corey Bishop at St. Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. So they are herpetologists. They know a lot about the salamanders and frogs. So the collaboration started when Ryan found this salamander in Canada. That species occur also in this part of the United States, the Connecticut and New York City, New York State.
The Northeast Corridor.
So northeastern part of the U.S. and also the eastern part of Canada. So this species is called Ambystoma maculatum. And so he was looking for some microbiologists who can help with analyzing, to help with understanding the algal part of the story. So these spotted salamander, they lay eggs in the vernal pond in the springtime. And almost all the spotted salamander you see in the nature, I would say 99.99% of the time, you see these green algal bloom inside of the egg, and that is caused by this green algae that forms symbiosis with the salamander embryos. So what happens is that these green algae, through the process of photosynthesis, give off oxygen, increase the oxygen tension, benefiting the embryo because the embryo need oxygen for respiration. And because these eggs are laid in a vernal pond, and which often go through anoxia, so the additional oxygen source from the algae really benefit the embryo. And in addition to this oxygen benefit, there has been this recent study showing that not only the algae benefiting the host with the oxygen, but there's some indication that some of the fixed carbon get transferred into the salamander host too. And also in return, this salamander release waste nitrogen in the form of ammonia, which is a waste product for the animal, but then that are useful nutrient source for the algae. So they are apparently benefiting each other, so mutualistic relationships.
That's fascinating. So once again, and it seems to be a theme, at least in this series that we've been doing on the origins of life and all these scientists that I talk to, is that life will out in the end. And that in some sense, we're seeing different kinds of life interacting.
Right. So that's the thing that I'm most interested in, like how life interact and amalgamate into a singular entity. The mitochondria is the same story. So I guess many students probably know mitochondria, the organelle responsible for respiration in human and also other animals and plants and fungi and also protists as well. And the mitochondria also once used to be free-living alpha proteobacteria for somehow form association with other type of eukaryotic life form or maybe alpha proteobacteria that evolve into these organellar structure.
Dr. Eun-Soo Kim is assistant curator in the Division of Invertebrate Zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. While Dr. Kim looks for microbes while on vacation, perhaps you'd prefer something a little more mainstream, like maybe watching sleeping lemurs. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. At the end of a stressful day, there's nothing like having a warm, safe place to sleep. And as Michelle Sauther, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado Boulder, reveals, humans aren't alone in seeking to come in from under the stars.
While we humans live in a stressful world that can disrupt sleep, in reality, primates, including humans, spend about one-third of their lives sleeping. Where we choose to sleep is a big deal. From an evolutionary perspective, one of the major factors that drives the choice of sleeping sites is safety. Studies of primates indicate that choosing a sleeping site that is inaccessible to predators is key. And in a novel study of human sleeping behavior by Spurl and Stich, they found that even humans prefer to place their beds so that they remain concealed from a bedroom's door while allowing them to view the door from a distance. While most social primates bed down together in trees, when we think of early humans, we often envision a cave as a sleeping site. Indeed, there is ample evidence in the form of ancient sleeping mats indicating that at least some ancient humans used rock shelters and caves as sleeping sites in South Africa. Our recent field research in southwestern Madagascar indicates that some groups of ring-tailed lemurs also regularly use caves as sleeping sites. Ring-tailed lemurs living in several sites along the coast of southwestern Madagascar inhabit spiny forests that provide few large trees for sleeping. These lemurs have solved this conundrum by consistently using the same caves on a daily basis, which they have been doing for at least 6 years. Like ancient humans, these ring-tailed lemurs appear to seek out caves for similar reasons, to avoid predators, to keep cool during hot days and warm during cool nights, and for access to water. Cave use by other primates is very rare, and our work adds to our understanding of the factors that may have driven the use of caves as shelters by our human ancestors.
That was Michelle Sauther of the University of Colorado Boulder. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.